Folks, please settle down for the next talk. We have Emmanuel Rocha, who will be talking about enabling architectural features in Debian, PAC, and BTI on ARM64. Over to you.
Thank you so much. Hello, everyone. Good afternoon.
Folks, please settle down.
Tafit, you're always standing up, man. Okay, so I would like to begin by telling you who I am. Lots of people in this room know me already, but for those who don't, my nickname is Emma on IRC and pretty much everywhere. I've been a Debian developer for a long time now, about 20 years, and since 2023, so a couple of years, I joined ARM as a Debian developer. And when I did, when I got the job, a friend asked a great question, and he said, why did they hire you, actually? Because Debian works already on ARM64, so that I don't see any point for you to be working there. Which I found, you know, is a very interesting question, given that, you know, Debian works on my laptop, probably works on your laptop as well, and it's not that we're closing the distro's dev room, we're saying, okay, work is done. Distro's development is a bit of an ongoing process, and it involves a lot of different moving parts, which is kind of the topic of this presentation. And also, my friend, when he asked the question, he got a, you know, unrequest, a very long explanation about what a Linux distro is, according to me. And you're getting the distilled version of that. So you could see a Linux distro just as a bunch of packages put together, maybe source or binary, depending on the type of distro. But there is more to that, of course. These packages are nice and all, but you need to install them on a system, otherwise, you know, they're not much use. On top of that, you could see it a bit differently and actually consider the distro as the release. So maybe the release process. We had talks today about different sort of rolling distros. Maybe that's what the you know, distribution agreed upon. Or you have stable releases that are, you know, cut at a certain point in time with a certain process. And this process is what also makes the distribution in a way. The group of people that then come up with agreements and discussions and then come up with rules and procedures and try to follow them. One talk before, two talks ago, someone said that the hardest thing in software development is convincing people to do things, and that's basically what this talk is about. I will use an ARM architectural feature as an example of enabling a change in the distribution, which is you know, touching different parts, and how this process is really mostly about talking to people at the end of the day. But given that the architectural features have two names, it seems prudent to tell you what these names are about, PAC and BTI. That's the first thing we'll talk about. Then I will tell you how we went about to enable the features, how we're checking the status of enablement, and what we're going to do next. PAC and BTI, what are these two crazy acronyms about? So these are two security features. The idea is to make a Linux distro better by mitigating control flow attacks. So the basic idea would be, you know, in the past you had very simple stack overflow attacks, stack smashing attacks, whereby you could have a buffer overflow vulnerability right past the intended end of the buffer and then inject some shellcode and you were already ready to go. Computer systems became better and now mostly, you know, not all buffers are not executable in general. So you cannot just do that, but what you can do, you can mount more sophisticated attacks whereby you hijack the control flow, hence the name control flow attacks, and you essentially redirect the execution flow to routines that would be legitimate and they are in memory for a reason, for example, glibc routines. But if you're clever enough, you can point to areas called gadgets in this area and chain them and mount an attack. There are two main categories of such attacks. One is called return-oriented programming attacks, and the other one is jump-oriented programming attacks. Similar, but a bit different. And PAC is the first mitigation called pointer authentication, and it's for ROP attacks. And the other mitigation is called BTI, branch target identification, and it's for jump-oriented programming attacks. I will tell you a little bit about both, but not a lot, because we don't have 3 hours. And PAC would be essentially, the idea is that in a return-oriented programming attack, what you're doing is you're exploiting the buffer overflow by overwriting the return address of the function. so that instead of getting back to wherever it was called, you begin that attack of chaining gadgets together. And the way PAC mitigates this is by signing the return address. So at the very beginning of the function, there is an assembly instruction that signs the return address, which is in the LR registry on ARM. And then just before returning, this address is authenticated. This signed address is authenticated. If authentication fails, the whole thing blows at runtime. If it's successful, everything continues working. BTI is a bit similar, but different. The idea with BTI is that the goal is to mitigate jump-oriented programming attacks, where the idea is not to work with the return address, but rather with jumps. And in a jump instruction, you can pass an arbitrary address. So we cannot have something to sign at the beginning of execution. We need to instead validate where we are jumping to. So the idea is to introduce new instructions called landing pads, or BTI, branch target identifiers, that we put wherever expected jumps are valid. So and if you jump anywhere else, you get an error. So that's it. There's a lot more, of course, to say about all this. At the end of the talk, I'll give you links to reference material if you want to read more. How did we enable all of this in the distro? Very simple. There is one flag to pass to either GCC or LLVM. You can say dash M, branch protection equals standard. You enable both. End of the talk. No. Well, you can also enable either PAC or BTI, but the work we did was, yes, to set this flag. But the deployment has a little, like a few concerns. There are a few things that we need to look for. In the case of PAC, it's fairly all right in the sense that we just add new instructions. If the instructions are there, they will be executed, of course. All the CPUs that were maybe designed before all of this came out are not going to have problems because these the new instructions were defined in the NOP space. So on old CPUs, you get NOPs instead of this stuff, which is nice. We don't have to provide multiple packages, you know, one package for more modern CPUs, for example, and another one for the old ones. So that's okay. We just have to rebuild the program and we're happy. For BTI, it's a bit more complicated. I mentioned that we are adding these new landing pads, so you can only jump into specific places, which means that when you're compiling, for example, a C program, you may have multiple C files that become object files, and then the linker puts them together. Now, it would be really sad if one of those object files would not have the landing pads, and then we put everything together, and if you jump in the wrong place, then the program crashes. That would be very bad. So to avoid that, the linker, when it's linking, checks whether actually all the object files have BTI enabled. And if they do, it says, okay, this thing can have BTI. And it does so by adding a note to the ELF section. So the ELF file will have a note that says, okay, this thing can, you know, can do BTI, which means that then the loader at runtime will check for it and will say, okay, this thing is BTI enabled. We can go ahead and enable it. There's a little trick here, though, a little thing. So even if you build the simplest Hello World program, you know, just one line of code that says print hello in C, that is going to use a couple of object files from GCC and glibc. And given that, as I said, all object files need to have BTI on, it means that even the simplest Hello World, in order to have BTI, needs to be built with a glibc and GCC that were previously built with BTI on. Right? So. This means that to enable all of this, we first have to put it in GCC and glibc, which means that we have to convince the GCC maintainer to do it and the glibc maintainer to do it, and then the package maintainer to also enable this flag for all packages in Debian. So this was mostly work of communication, talking to people, asking nicely, and so forth. We got all of this in July 22nd, 2024. So all packages uploaded to Debian after this date started getting BTI on. How do we track all of this? So how do we check which packages have it on, which don't, and what has to be done? So as I said, the whole idea is that you get a new node in the ELF. So if you just type readelf dash dash nodes and the executable, you will get the nodes, and then you can check if BTI is on or not, which is pretty simple and nice. So one of the things I did is, because of course I don't just want to analyze LS, I would like to know whether the whole Debian archive has BTI on or not, and which packages still have to be enabled, and what's the status. And possibly also regressions, so if something has BTI and then suddenly doesn't have it anymore because somebody dropped the flag, who knows why, it would be nice to know that. So I wrote a few scripts that use snapshot debian.org. I'm sure many of you know what that is, but it's essentially a very cool service. It's a bit like a time machine for the Debian archive. It has a very nice JSON API that gives you the list of all snapshots available, and then you can point your sources list, for example, at a certain snapshot, and then you can install Debian SID precisely as it was 2 weeks ago, for instance. So this seemed like a very cool way to find out what was the BTI enablement status at a given point in time in the past and how it's progressing. So the idea is to get the list of all, well, to download all the architecture-dependent packages from snapshot.debian.org at a certain day. For all of them, extract the package, go through all the ELF files, see which ones have the feature on and which ones don't, and then print pretty graphs. Downloading the archive doesn't take a lot, it's about 20 minutes, while being nice to the service and having only 7 or 8 parallel downloads and so forth. And then running the analysis on a VM with 8 cores takes about half an hour, so this is perfectly fine. It could be optimized, but 50 minutes to analyze the whole Debian archive is all right. We don't do it too often. And this is essentially the output of that set of scripts. The red line on top is the number of binary packages in Debian that ship at least one ELF file, a bit less than 25,000. You can see that the red line goes a bit up and down. That depends on whether new packages have been introduced or some packages have been dropped. But it stays fairly constant. And then on the bottom, you'll see the blue line. And starting from when we got glibc and gcc rebuilt, and we added the default flags, then slowly all packages being uploaded to the archive started getting BTI. So the blue curve follows precisely, you know, uploads to Debian. That's the only thing it is. And it goes up, but it seemed to go fairly slowly, right? I mean, there's probably a lot of packages that don't get uploaded so often. So during a chat with Paul Hevers in Cambridge, from the release team, we came up with the obvious idea of trying to rebuild everything and see which packages in Debian would get BTI if we were just to rebuild them with the right flags. So he had this great idea, and I said, oh, that sounds like what we should do. I made a list of packages that have at least one ELF file. We don't want to rebuild packages that only ship PDFs, for example, because they don't get BTI. And then I've rebuilt them all, and I checked whether they do get BTI or not with the scripts you've seen before. And it turned out, to my delight, that many of them did. About 7,000 source packages did get BTI on. So then we said, okay, let's mass rebuild them all, right? Let's rebuild them all so that we basically close that gap you've seen earlier. Before doing so, I double-checked that all those packages were actually uploaded before July 22nd. Otherwise, it seemed like something strange. They should have gotten BTI already if they were built already with the proper toolchain. That was the case, so I didn't embarrass myself by sending a list of wrong packages. And so I've asked the release team to please rebuild those 7,000 packages, which in Debianese you have to say schedule bin NMUs, please. And Sebastian Ramacher did all the work of scheduling the rebuilds. So thank you very much to both Sebastian and Paul, if you see this. Yeah, and the graph looks much better after that. Those are all the rebuilds that were staggered across a couple of days. And then after that, the line keeps on following pretty much precisely packages being added or removed. It doesn't grow too much, as expected, because we already got everything that would get BTI with a simple rebuild. So what can we do next to try and further shrink that gap in the next weeks? So in that graph, you've seen that there are about 19,000 packages that have BTI, and there's 5,000 that don't. Those binary packages come from 3,500 source packages. And so the realization is that we can probably categorize them. So we can see how comes those packages. You know, there are so many packages that don't get BTI if you rebuild them. And the realization is that GCC and LLVM are not the only compilers in Debian that produce ELF files. Fabian is reading because is laughing because he's in the Rust team. And so we started looking at this list and categorizing these packages by language. So now a bit of trivia. What do you think is the language which is the biggest offender in all of this?
Haskell.
Yes. There are a ton of packages in Debian that are written in Haskell, and they are, you know, they have ELF files, so not interpreted Haskell, but you actually produce an ELF file. And what is the next one then?
Erlang?
Close. There's a big language, there's a dev room about it somewhere here. It's Go. Go is the next one. And then somebody said Objective Camel, and that's indeed in the list as well. And then we finally have Rust. The reason why Rust is, I mean, of course, there's a lot of software in Debian that uses Rust in different ways. But Firefox is not part of all of this, because Firefox already ships binaries that are not, you know, pure, built with a Rust compiler. So those are, that's a package that we don't consider in this. These are pure Rust packages built with Rust C and everything. Okay, so the obvious idea now is to fix these compilers. For Haskell, there is already work ongoing at ARM. A colleague of mine called Bill is working on this. And for Go and Rust, there are two upstream issues. And they, again, seem to be mostly about communication. So there's a long discussion and people arguing about things. And so I really hope this moves a bit further, so that we can get, you know, Debian more secure, essentially. And then once that is all done, there will be a long tail of another about 1,300 packages that don't fall in those categories. So they're written in C or C++, but they just ignore C flags completely. So they don't use the C flags you set. They override C flags for various reasons. I'm sure some are very good reasons. I'm sure some are very bad reasons. So we will have to look into all of those, and then there's probably also going to be a very long tail of strange cases, like stuff written in assembly, God knows. Okay, to conclude, PAC and BTI are useful features, I think, in ARM64, and they will be available in Trixie. All those packages you've seen before will be fully protected by both PAC and BTI. There's a wiki page there with all the details about what I've talked today and much more, of course. There's also, towards the end of the wiki page, a reference section with a bunch of PDFs that really explain in detail PAC and BTI and the control flow attacks and how the countermeasures work. So if you're interested, please go ahead and take a look. And I also wanted to make the point that distribution work is not only hacking in front of the keyboard, but it's also talking in front of the keyboard, perhaps, with other people, and coordinating and tracking status and trying to convince folks that something is worth doing and so on. Additionally, another point I wanted to make is that distro work is also about integration. So if the integration is not done, the feature is not there. You can come up with the best possible feature in the world, very clever, supported in the kernel, supported in the C library, in the bootloader and whatnot. But then if you don't do the integration work and put everything together, then the feature is essentially not there. And that's all I had. Any questions or comments?
Hi, thank you for the great talk. I'm mostly interested in like those packages that you mentioned that ignore C flags. because of the actually for my own personal reasons for I run the debugging for the service in Debian, and that's also impacted by that decision in packages. So I was wondering if you have a list of those packages that like maybe we can work on and help with BTI and debugging for the.
So. Oh, this would be lovely. So I do have a full list of all packages that are not into those categories.
Right.
So packages that did not get the feature enabled and are not written in Haskell, Rust, and so forth. So all of those are good candidates to look at. Yeah. There are about 1,300, so the list is long.
Yeah.
But some are immediately obvious. There are a few where you open the make file and it just sets C flags equals dash O zero. That's it.
Yeah.
So you know that's a pretty simple one. And others are trickier because maybe they use arcane build systems and it's not that easy to figure out where things are at. But yeah, I would love to work with you on that.
That's great.
There's also, I forgot the name of it, but there's a system to grab build logs, essentially, and see if certain flags are set or not.
Right. That's
so
a good...
Maybe we could use that as well.
Yeah, that's a good one. I've been using that system for... But I don't have a full list of them, so I just... If you do, that's great. Thank you.
Cool. Sure.
So you mentioned assembler. What if inline assembler is missing these landing pads or signing instructions?
Right. So there is the option of writing the landing pads. Right. So you can write your assembly in a way that you put the landing pads in the right place and things work. And then you manually have to mark the object as BTI enabled. So that then the linker will see, okay, this is a, like somebody claims this is BTI enabled, probably is, and then when it puts things together, it will turn the feature on. So that's essentially the idea. There's an article also referenced in the sections that explains how to do all this. So there is the way to, well, the best idea would be to not use the assembly, if possible, but there are cases where you can't, of course, and there is a way to do that.